first time I was flying by jet propulsion. No engine vibrations, no torque, and no lashing sound of the propeller. Accompanied by a whistling sound, my jet shot through the air. Later, when asked what it felt like, I said, "It felt as though angels were pushing." Luftwaffe General Adolf Galland. Hello, and welcome to World of Warbirds. I'm Brian Pierce. Since the Wright brothers embarked on their first flight on December 17, 1903, traveling only 120 feet, they knew that there was going to be something more to this sport we call flying. As time passed, and as more and more people caught on to that idea that aviation was a growing evolution, they knew, too, there could be more to it. Each group and generation of dreamers, designers, manufacturers, and pilots added more and more to it. Welcome to Tanner's Just Jets, where we cover more than just jets. We'll be looking at the engines, the planes, the pilots, and of course, the firepower. In the late days of World War II, the United States was really starting to see jet propulsion-powered engines to possibly be the next big thing in aerial warfare. As air combat was rapidly changing at this time, they wanted in. Piston engines had hit a spot where their power was optimized and the law of physics prevented further growth. But what exactly is a jet engine? Here's a quick review. In a reciprocating four-cycle piston engine, or the usual propeller engine, within each cylinder, valves and spark plugs control the sequence of the four cycles: intake, compression, ignition, and exhaust. Intake: a downgoing piston draws in a charge of fuel and air. Compression: this piston, now upgoing, compresses the charge. Ignition: the squeezed fuel-air charge is ignited, burns, and expands, and pushes the piston down to produce power and exhaust. This upgoing piston completes the cycle by pushing out exhaust gases, and then the cycle starts all over again. Notice that in a four-cycle engine, the only stroke producing power is the ignition one. On the other hand, in a turbojet, all of these functions take place simultaneously within the straight line of the jet engine. In the front, a compressor performs its job of drawing in and squeezing the incoming air and pushing it back, so performing the intake and compression. And then the air is mixed with fuel, burned, and then it rushes to escape through the power turbine at the back, so ignition and exhaust, otherwise known as thrust. The whole thing is joined by a shaft, so that the faster the turbine turns, the more air is compressed in the front. It's actually much more simple than a reciprocating engine, and as thrust is being produced constantly, much more powerful. The USA was a little late to the jet party. Initially, the main participants were Germany and Britain. In Germany, Hans Ohain had started with Heinkel and his experiments had eventually produced the BMW 003 and U-Mode 004 engines that had powered the ME-262 amongst other Luftwaffe jet aircraft of the Second World War. Meanwhile, over in Britain, Frank Whittle's work eventually led to the Rolls-Royce Welland turbojet that powered the Gloster Meteor. But still, the USA had been testing jet propulsion engines since the early days of the war. In 1942, the Bell P-59 Era Comet was no doubt flying, but the engines were not satisfactory as thrust was too low for the heavy airframe. As research and technology got better, closer to the end of the war, the jet option was looking a bit more viable, and the United States started putting out its first contracts. One of these was released by the U.S. Navy in 1945, looking for a jet-powered night fighter that would be able to take off and land on carriers. Well, one company that submitted a proposal was Grumman. In the late years of the war, Grumman had started dabbling in jet propulsion. When word started to come out the United States military was looking to start testing the use of jet engine aircraft, they stuck some early Allison J-33 engines onto an airframe they were developing and submitted it as Grumman Proposal 75, or G-75 to keep it short. However, in April 1946, the contract was awarded to Douglas, resulting in the F-3D Sky Knight, a two-seat, twin-engine, radar-equipped jet that deserves its own story. While not the outcome Grumman was hoping for, the U.S. Navy's Bureau of Aeronautics did give them a backup contract to build and test two of their G-75s that were now known as Designation X-F9F1. After it was built, Grumman came to the realization that it sucked. With the early J-33 engine on the G-75 airframe, it did not produce enough thrust, making it extremely underpowered. And at this point, the J-33 couldn't get much better, and the airframe couldn't get much smaller. The engines were mounted on the wings, so there was already a chance of a small fuel load, and so it seemed like this was the end of the line for the G-75. While perhaps the Navy Bureau of Aeronautics should have canceled it outright, instead, they changed another one of Grumman's contract wordings to include a new version of the G-75, which was called the G-79. At the time, as jet technology was so new, Grumman didn't have many options in the class of jet engines to go with for this new version. The two main engines the U.S. produced domestically were the Allison-made J-33 centrifugal jet engine already used on the prototype, and the Westinghouse J-34 with the axial compressor. The Allison-made J-33 was being used by the U.S. Air Forces in the F-94 Starfighter and the P-80 Shooting Star, the P-80 being the first American operational combat jet. The Westinghouse J-34 was being used by the Navy, powering the F-2H Banshee and the jet she was battling for position with, the previously mentioned F-3D Sky Knight. So, if both domestically produced engines are insufficient to meet your needs, what do? Go international. I mean, it had worked before with the Rolls-Royce Merlin in the P-51 Mustang, so why not? The Navy told Grumman to use the imported Rolls-Royce Nene, which was developing successfully in Britain with the de Havilland Vampire and Hawker Seahawk. The Rolls-Royce Nene showed to produce 5,000 pounds of thrust compared to the Westinghouse's J-34 with only 3,000 pounds. Now, jet thrust sounds very complicated, but it's not. To break it down, 1 pound of thrust is equal to holding 1 pound of the object the engine was attached to suspended in the air, as if the engines were pointed straight at the ground. Rolls-Royce gave the rights to build the Nene engine to Pratt & Whitney in the USA under the name J-42. This would be provided to Grumman, and the J-75 earned the name F-9F Panther, and she was off to the races. When it comes to prototypes, although in some ways the Panther was a conventional fighter fitted with jet engines, for example, the wings were not swept, in other ways, she had many upgrades. The Panther was of all-metal construction with a mid-mounted straight wing, tricycle landing gear, and a stinger-type arrestor hook under the exhaust. The wing featured leading-edge and trailing-edge flaps, and the wings folded hydraulically upward from just outboard of the main gear. The tail assembly was of a conventional configuration with a mid-mounted tailplane. The main gear hinged in the wings to retract towards the fuselage, while the nose wheel retracted backwards. There was a split, perforated air brake just behind the nose wheel doors, and for maintenance, both the nose and tail coverings could be pulled off. The pilot sat on an ejection seat in a pressurized cockpit under an all-round vision canopy that slid backwards hydraulically to open. There was a small step on the lower fuselage that could be slid out to help the pilot get in and out of the aircraft. Due to the J-42 engines being attached on the wings of the Panther and the cigar-like fuselage, the Panther had insufficient room for fuel in the wings. So two fixed wingtip fuel tanks, one on each wing, were added to supplement the 683 gallons in the fuselage tank. Close to the end of the Second World War, the Navy had switched from 50 caliber machine guns to 20 millimeter cannons. As the armor and material used for building aircraft got better and better, the slam of the 50 caliber got weaker and weaker, and Air Forces knew that it would be time to switch. But when handed the design for the British 20mm Hispano, the engineering didn't go so well at testing. They ran into a high probability of gun jams and overall poor performance. This caused a bad taste, causing them to stick with the 50s until the 20mm could be proven they're worth better, and a switch to the Hispano was made later on. Instead of the usual Grumman design of the gun's cannons being placed in the wing roots, they were placed in the nose. This allowed for more streamlined, accurate firing, a burst of four cannon right from the gun sight, no convergence of the guns to worry about. The first XF9F2 prototype performed its initial flight on the 21st of November 1947, and although the later second prototype crashed, there was no real delay to the program, and the Panther started to be delivered to the Navy in 1949. When it comes to production, the Panther's initial role was that of a night fighter, but the Navy soon realized air-to-ground would be the Panther's bread and butter, and most airframes got bomb and rocket pylons. The F9F2P was fitted with aerial reconnaissance cameras and was used extensively on recon missions during the Korean War. The F9F3 was fitted with the Allison J-33 just in case the Rolls-Royce Nene ever became too much of a hassle, and she was the first plane fitted with bleed air, a concept that uses compressed air from the engine turbines, turning it into a secondary power source, and can be used in many ways, cooling the engine, cabin pressurization, de-icing, and on modern planes it pressurizes the lavatory you use. For the Panther, it was used to add power to the engines to keep from stalling when landing on a carrier. The F9F5 used the Pratt & Whitney J-48 engine, which was an enlarged Rolls-Royce Nene and was fitted for a K reconnaissance version. The F9F5K, being redesignated QF9D, was essentially a zombie Panther, used as an unmanned target drone for air-to-air practice. When it comes to operational history, the Panther was deployed by both the U.S. Marines and the U.S. Navy, and it was mainly used in a ground strike role. Some of the assets she used for this task were the six high-velocity aerial rockets, known as HVAR, under the wings. There were choices of 100, 250, 500, or 1,000-pound bombs and the not-so-tiny Tiny Tim rocket. The Panther first saw combat 1 month into the Korean War, flying a ground strike mission taking off from CV-45 USS Valley Forge. As the Soviets and Chinese supplied more and more anti-aircraft guns to the North Koreans, the Panther started to take up the role of taking them out. This caused a high cost for AA guns, but also for the Panthers. Besides ground strike missions, the Panther also performed reconnaissance missions. And while not known for it, she was also not afraid to shabby up to a good old dogfight. In fact, the Panther has a very cool record that needs to be covered. Bearcat with me here. She scored the first U.S. naval kill of the Korean War, shooting down a propeller-driven Yak-9 on July 3, 1950. Only 6 days after the Panther flew her first mission. Impressive, huh? Just wait. While being inferior to the MiG-15 in many ways, disadvantages can become advantages in the hands of the right fighter pilot. Using the slower speed, they could get MiG-15s to overshoot, ending them up in a bad position in front of the Panthers' four deadly Hispano cannons, and the MiGs would become mincemeat. The overall kill rate was 7 MiG-15s downed for 2 Panthers, the first being shot down by Lieutenant Commander William Aden of Fighter Squadron VF-111, the Sundowners. After the war, she went on to replace the F-8F Bearcat, performing with the United States Blue Angels from 1951 to 1955, being the Blues' first jet. The only other nation to operate the F-9F Panther was the Argentine Navy, so shout out to them. If we want to look at some notable pilots that flew the F-9F, Neil Armstrong was a naval aviator before stepping on the moon, and he flew the Panther. In 1951, while flying low over a valley, he struck a wire strung across, causing him to eject from the aircraft. Speaking of astronauts, John Glenn also flew the Panther with the Marines. Famous baseball player Ted Williams also flew her. But there's one story that only recently being discovered is definitely worth a highlight. On November 18, 1952, four naval aviators, including Lieutenant Royce Williams, launched from the deck of USS Oriskany in the middle of a blizzard to intercept 7 MiG-15s that were flying towards their task group from the border of China and North Korea. Williams noticed 7 contrails and, believing these to be the target, moved to intercept. So that's 7 versus 4. But then one of Williams' squadron mates had some fuel pump issues with his aircraft and had to return back to the carrier, being escorted by his wingmen. They did not land, though. They stuck around the carrier on a CAP, Combat Air Patrol. But now we're down to 7 versus 2. Just then, 2 MiG-15s swept down, firing at Williams and his wingmen. These MiG-15s had Soviet stars on the wings and tail, meaning the Soviets had fired on U.S. aircraft, even though they were not at war at the time. Williams got orders to intercept them again before they could reach the aircraft carrier, so he and his wingmen caught up and Williams fired at the closest MiG, with Williams' wingman chasing it. Chasing is all the wingman could do because his guns were jammed and they would not fire. So now, we're at 7 versus 1. But that first MiG had been hit and fell, helping the odds a little. Following this was a 35-minute-long, gut-wrenching, fear-rattling dogfight between Panthers and MiG-15s, with Williams scoring 3 more kills after his first. He kept fighting and firing until his guns ran empty, and only then did he start to return to the carrier. But then he noticed one last MiG pulling up on his tail. But then Williams' wingman pulled up on his tail too, which spooked him, and that MiG-15 buggered off. It was finally the end of one of the longest dogfights in history. While returning to the base, Williams noticed that he had no rudder control. Luckily, he was pretty even, and the aircraft held that way for a landing on the carrier. Afterwards, the crew counted 263 holes in the jet, showing the pure ruggedness of the F-9F and the Grumman's famous ironworks American engineering. Williams couldn't even brag about his score, though. The fight, which could have caused an international incident and a potential war with the Soviet Union, was not revealed. The records were scrubbed, and Williams was instructed not to talk about it. Even much later, when the incident had been revealed, and there was a move to get the Medal of Honor for Williams' achievement, there were few records to back it up. It finally took declassified Soviet documents on the Korean War to definitively prove what had happened. Igor Seidov, a Russian military historian, wrote of the incident in his book Red Devils Over the Yalu, a chronicle of Soviet aerial operations in the Korean War. Seidov stated that 7 MiGs left Vladivostok that morning and only one returned to base. 4 were shot down by one U.S. Panther. One MiG had been severely damaged and crashed on its way back to base, and the seventh plane just disappeared without a trace. 40 years after the engagement, during an interview, Williams was able to finally name four of the pilots he shot down. They were Soviet captains Bilikhanov, Vandalov, and Soviet lieutenants Takhob Kim and Tarshinov. He also made sure to take the time to compliment the ruggedness of the aircraft that Grumman had made, the F-9F Panther. There are still many surviving F-9F Panthers at museums, and one airframe still flying. The airworthy one is at the North Texas Regional Airport in Denison, Texas. Some noteworthy static models are the one at the National Aviation Museum in Pensacola, Florida, hanging from the ceiling with six HVARs, and one at Lions Park in Costa Mesa, California, and VFW Post 1621 in Janesville, Wisconsin. And lastly, there is a replica of Royce Williams' Panther on the USS Midway Museum's flight deck bearing four MiG kill symbols. Well, I hope you guys enjoyed the first episode of Tanner's Just Jets. I hope we did justice on the F-9F Panther. If you guys enjoyed this, please feel free to drop a comment on our Facebook, or Patreon, or YouTube. Till next time, remember, there's always something more to this sport we call flying, so never stop dreaming and never stop believing. This is call sign Tanner, signing off.